Welcome to a special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. Many influential and significant jazz artists have come out of the state of Indiana, but the Hoosier Heartland has also produced several notable songwriters and vocal groups as well, including Cole Porter, Hoagy Carmichael, The Four Freshmen, and The Ink Spots. We'll hear music from these and other composers and performers and talk with Smithsonian American music curator John Hassey and Indiana University music professors Timothy Noble and Glenn Gass, and feature archival interview remarks from jazz historian Richard Sudhalter and Four Freshmen co-founder Ross Barber, how Indiana songwriters and singers left their mark on American popular music and the jazz canon with A National Road of Song, coming up next on Nightlights.
Now we have a real surprise. Hoagy's mother, who taught him to play piano by ear when he was a kid, lives right here in Indianapolis, and we ask her to drop in and say hello. Hoagy, will you take your mother's arm and march right out here on the stage?
All right, Tommy. Right up here, Mother. Now come up here right by the piano. Come on.
Mrs. Carmichael, it's really wonderful to have you here.
Yeah, thank you, Tommy. When Hoagland said I was going to be on stage before a lot of people and on the radio all over the country, I was scared to death.
Now, Mother, I don't believe that at all. You're not scared when you play the piano, are you?
Well, no, I used to play, Hoagland.
And you still do, Mrs. Carmichael. I know, because I heard that home recording that you and Hoagy made.
Thank you.
Now, Mother, let's hear you play the Maple Leaf Rag just the way you used to play it in the movies years ago. And Mother, swing that bass.
All right, Hoagland.
The rim of the hill.
Ella Fitzgerald doing Indiana native Cole Porter's In the Still of the Night from Ella Fitzgerald Sings the Cole Porter Songbook. And before that, Hoagie Carmichael's mother, Lida, playing a song published just 2 months before Hoagie Carmichael was born in November of 1899. Scott Joplin's The Maple Leaf Rag with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra on a radio broadcast from the Lyric Theater in downtown Indianapolis in 1939. The state of Indiana has produced notable jazz artists such as J.J. Johnson, Wes Montgomery, and Freddie Hubbard. In this episode of Jazz Crossroads of America, we'll take a look at several key songwriters and singing groups that emerged from the Hoosier heartland. And we'll start all the way back in Indianapolis in the years before World War I, when ragtime was on the rise. Ragtime was a homegrown American music that drew on both African-American and European rhythmic approaches, the immediate forerunner of jazz. And Indianapolis played host to a number of successful composers and sheet music publishers of the genre. Smithsonian American Music curator and ragtime expert John Hassey says that household pianos, which in those days were as much a feature of daily home life as TVs and computers are today, helped fuel the ragtime boom.
In 1909, more or less smack dab in the middle of the ragtime era, piano sales hit their all-time high. And, you know, with all these pianos being sold, people needed music to play in them. Ragtime seemed perfectly suited because it took advantage of the piano's range. It required a certain amount of technical facility, in some cases virtuosity, and it was a music you could dance to. Parents might not always like it, but the young people flocked to ragtime as they would to rock and roll in the 1950s.
Hassey cites Indianapolis's central location, culture, and ethnic makeup for the role it played in ragtime's success.
Indianapolis has the almost singular position of being smack dab in the middle of a state, its largest city and its capital, and with a great transportation network. There were 16 railroads going in and out of Indianapolis, and almost two dozen interurbans. These were electrified railways that went between cities, and from there, from Indianapolis, you could go to Chicago, you could go to Louisville on these interurban. So it was, a lot of ideas were flowing in and out of Indianapolis. It was on the National Road, and you had famous writers there like Booth Tarkington, Theodore Paul Dreiser came from Indiana. You had James Whitcomb Riley. As well, you had an unusual ethnic mix in Indianapolis, as you did in Cincinnati and St. Louis. A lot of African-Americans and a lot of people of German extraction. And the Germans brought with them oftentimes a love of classical music, and they were often the music teachers. Over in St. Louis, for example, Scott Joplin studied with a German music teacher named Alfred Ernst. And, you know, you can make an association or correlation between the German stereotypical love of the march in 2-4 multiple strains with a oompa left hand, and those same characteristics of ragtime, 2-4, multiple strains, and an oompa left hand.
One German ragtime composer who came from Indianapolis showed that the ragtime composing field was not just a man's game either.
May Alfterheide was one of the leading, and some would say the leading, female composer of ragtime in the United States. She had 7 piano rags and a couple of ragtime songs, and what puts her above some of the others is not just the quantity, but the fact that several of these evidently became something of hits and went into oral tradition down in New Orleans, because decades later, the rediscovered New Orleans trumpeter Bunk Johnson knew them by heart, played them from memory, and recorded them. Thank you.
Bunk Johnson performing May Ofterhider's Thriller Rag in 1942. The music of other Indiana ragtime composers would surface in the post-ragtime era as well. For example, J. Russell Robinson's Singin' the Blues, as done in 1927 by Bix Beiderbecke and Frankie Trumbauer, would become one of the most important recordings of early jazz history. As the ragtime era began to give way to the jazz age, another Indianapolis songwriter found fame on Broadway. Noble Sissel had made his first musical mark in World War I as an important member of James Reese Europe's Black Regimental Band, the so-called Harlem Hellfighters, that were a forerunner of Glenn Miller's World War II military service band. Here he is with Europe singing How You Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm in 1919.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after this scene, Harry? How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, dancing around and painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's the mystery. They'll never want to see a rake of plow, and who's a deuce and Polly Boo a cow? How you gonna keep them down on the farm after this scene, Paris?
After Europe's untimely death in 1919 brought an end to the orchestra, Sissel teamed up with a new partner.
Noble Sissel went on to collaborate with a pianist out of Baltimore named Eubie Blake. They first performed in vaudeville, and then they wrote two Broadway musicals that became tremendous hits, Shuffle Along in about 1923, and The Chocolate Dandies. And Shuffle Along was such a breakthrough. It was the first time you'd had an all-black cast, doing stand-up kind of songs, as opposed to some of the racially demeaning songs that were on the stage earlier in the 20th century. And it was such a hit that it caused traffic jams on Broadway.
I'm in love, so in love.
Who is the guy? Who is the guy you're crazy about? Oh, oh.
Who'd like to know? You'd like to know? Well, hear me shouting. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. The heavenly blisses of his kisses fill me with ecstasy. He's sweet just like chocolate candy, and just like honey from a bee. Oh, I'm just wild about Harry, and he's just wild about, cannot do without. He's just wild about me and Harry.
Oh, she's just wild about Harry. La la ho.
Yeah, and he's just wild about me. Those heavenly blisses of those sweet kisses fill me with ecstasy. Gee, he's sweet like candy, and just like honey from a bumblebee. Oh, I'm just wild about H-A-R-R-Y. And he's just wild about you, cannot do without you. He's just wild about you.
Alice Faye with Louis Prima's band doing Noble Sissel and Eubie Blake's I'm Just Wild About Harry from the groundbreaking Broadway musical Shuffle Along. Noble Sissel wasn't the only African-American songwriter from Indianapolis to score a hit in the 1920s. Pianist Leroy Carr teamed up with guitarist Scrapper Blackwell for a series of popular blues recordings.
He was born in Nashville, Tennessee in 1905, but he spent some formative years in Indianapolis in the late 20s and the early part of the 30s until his untimely death in 1935. But during those 7 years when he was recording, from 1928 to 1935, he was a major influence. He had almost a crooning style of singing, very smooth, not rough edge like some of the country blues singers did, and a real smooth, very appealing style at the piano.
Mr. Engineman, turn your train around. My baby's on there, and she's southern bound. long has that evening train been gone? She left me standing, throwing up my hands, said she was going back to other men. How long has that evening train been gone? Ain't that too bad? How long has that evening train been gone?
Leroy Carr would pass away in 1935 at the age of 30 from alcoholism, around the time that another one of his hit songs was recorded by an Indianapolis street corner singing group, the Ink Spots, heard here doing In the Evening When the Sun Goes Down. The Ink Spots performing fellow Indianapolis musician Leroy Carr's In the Evening When the Sun Goes Down. The origins of the Ink Spots go back to late 1920s and early 30s groups known as the Percolating Puppies, the Riff Brothers, and King Jack and Jester. By the time of their mid-1930s incarnation as the Ink Spots, they were a jazz and jive quartet. Here they are doing a song called Swingin' on the Strings.
Swingin' on the string like nobody's business. Swingin' cause we just can't keep from swingin'. When that native corner boys come creepin', there's nothing left to do but keep on swingin'.
Yeah. It's so heavenly, makes you feel so good. Uh-huh. Make down harmony, that is understood.
Swingin' on the strings like nobody's business. Swinging, cause we just can't keep from swinging.
Indiana University professor of music Glenn Gass on the significance of the Ink Spots.
Once they got really popular and people like my dad would start to listen to them, you know, my dad wouldn't normally listen to black music, but the Ink Spots or Nat King Cole, for example, were usually popular in the 1940s, you know, because they didn't sound like Muddy Waters, you know, it was an accessible sound, and Bill Kenny was the model for all the doo-wop crooning tenors, the romantic leads to come along. And then that little Hoppy Jones, those little talking basses. I mean, Elvis, I wonder if you're lonesome tonight, you know, right out of the Ink Spots songbook. I think that the sheer success of the Ink Spots sort of influenced the formation of so many groups, on, especially on the East Coast. It's like, wow, look at them. They're making it. Let's start our own group. And it's something you can do with if you don't take music lessons and don't own a set of drums. You can get in the stairwell and sing. So, you know, it's kind of a winding road to get from Ink Spots to doo-wop, but it's a pretty clear one, you know. And I think they were the model against which all, especially in the 40s, all groups were held.
If I didn't care, honey child, more than words can say. If I didn't care, would I feel this way? Darling, if this isn't love, then why do I thrill so much? And what is it that makes my head go round and round while my heart just stand still so much.
If I didn't care, would it be the same?
If the Ink Spots were the personification of a street corner singing group, art in an everyday American setting, then Cole Porter was the exemplar of a high society artistic figure out on the town and abroad. Born in Peru, Indiana in 1891 into a wealthy family, Porter's musical talent blossomed early under his mother's guidance, and during his undergraduate years at Yale, he began to compose songs, 300 of them by some accounts. He was a relative latecomer as a Broadway success, scoring his first hit at the age of 36 with Paris in 1928, but his music provided a virtual soundtrack for the sophisticated side of American life and love in the 1930s, with songs such as Night and Day, You're the Top, Begin the Begin, Easy to Love, I've Got You Under My Skin, and other songs brimming with wit, romance, and often provocative commentary. Porter was gay, and he spent the 1920s leading a luxurious lifestyle in Europe. Indiana University professor of vocal music and Porter expert Timothy Noble thinks these years had an impact on Porter's successful music of the 1930s.
His songs, he was in this almost subculture in Paris, where it was gay, bisexual, anything kind of goes deal. He really was. And I mean, Paris in the 20s was a wild place, especially after the war. I mean, everybody just went nuts. And that's understandable, I suppose. But he came out of that. I guess you could say that had a big effect on his music. A lot of his music was censored in the United States. Did you know that? Amazing. If, for instance, I get no kick from champagne. Wrong lyric. I get no kick from cocaine. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So, I mean, he had stuff like that. And then he wrote a song on the banks of the Mississippi. It's on the banks of the Mississippi about two lovely Indian maidens and their sugar papa. You know, it's crazy stuff like that. And so he was a little risque and he pushed it to the edge. And in those days, that was really verboten. You know, you couldn't talk about stuff like that.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got the shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose, anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if bare limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that smart is intruding at nudist parties in studio, anything goes.
Cole Porter performing his own Anything Goes in 1934. Porter's songs are among the foremost entries in what's known as the Great American Songbook, and they've endured partly because they were embraced almost from the start by jazz musicians as well as singers. Timothy Noble says jazz artists found inspiration not only in Porter's melodies, but in his words as well.
The harmonies are sophisticated, you know, and they're accessible for improvisation, you know. I know you look at any sheet, you know, you've got a couple of books here with Cole Porter's music in it, and you can look at it on a printed page, and I guarantee you that you listen to him sing his music, and he doesn't follow the notes per se. It was about the lyrics, and I think that great jazz musicians do the same kind of thing with this kind of music. They play the lyrics.
Jazz writer Will Friedwald cites Porter's Night and Day as one of numerous Porter songs that hold great appeal for jazz performers, touting its repeated notes and bouncy rhythms, and its intriguing harmonic pattern, with its shifts from minor to major keys that make it appealing to improvisers. The song, Friedwald declares, is at once complicated and simple. Here's jazz singer Billie Holiday's 1939 interpretation of it.
Night and Day, you are the one. Beneath the moon and under the sun, with the far. It's no matter, darling, where you are. I think of you night and day, day and night. Why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you night and day, night and day. No such a hungry yearning burning inside of me, and its torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you night and day, day and night.
In 1937, at the age of 46, Cole Porter suffered a crippling horse riding accident that would lead to numerous operations and medications. He continued to write songs for new Broadway shows at a highly productive pace, and despite his physical and psychological pain, he maintained the playfully sensual spirit of his lyric writing.
There's a song in Silk Stockings called All of You, which I think is just incredible, and it's really very graphic. Because it's, you know, it goes, I love the looks of you, the lure of you. I'd love to make a tour of you. And that's not with a map, honey. I'm telling you. You know. And so, and I think it's a great song. And all those wonderful songs from Kiss Me, Kate, you know. He wrote some of his best stuff. Can-Can is a great show. That's what comes to mind. But I mean, you know, after 1937, he was as prolific as any composer we've ever had.
Porter's later music would continue to find favor with jazz musicians as well. Here's John Coltrane in 1962 performing Porter's Out of This World. In 1958, Cole Porter's right leg had to be amputated, and he ceased writing songs, living the rest of his life in a secluded manner before passing away in 1964. Timothy Noble says the range of Porter's music was a reflection of his life.
The entire genre of popular song, okay, he covered. Not just the elegance, not just the lyric, not just the witticism, but humor, pathos, passion. I mean, he had a hell of a life if you look back at it. He really did. And he experienced everything. And he was not, you know, he was a very courageous man, I think, to be able to do the things that he did with that kind of pain, even though he's on drugs, and to continue to work. A lot of people probably would have bagged it and gone home. He didn't.
We'll have more music from Indiana singers and songwriters in just a few moments. The Nightlight series Jazz Crossroads of America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, bringing the arts to all Americans. Production support for Nightlights also comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl and from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House. You can listen to this and other Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to A National Road of Song, a special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights.
Hot, 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 hot.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
Welcome back to A National Road of Song, another episode of Jazz Crossroads of America. The singing group, the Four Freshmen, really were freshmen when they all met at the Arthur Jordan Conservatory of Music in Indianapolis in 1947. They were all homegrown Hoosiers, too. Brothers Ross and Don Barber came from Columbus, Bob Flanagan hailed from Greencastle, and Hal Cratch was from Warsaw. They were also all fans of big band leader Stan Kenton, who helped shape their sound and their career. Four Freshmen co-founder, drummer, and vocalist Ross Barber on the group's unique style.
Well, we were instrumentalists, except Don, but Hal and I were trumpet players, and Bob was a trombone player. Bob sings lead, and he wanted the quartet to sound like a trombone section, and we were such Kenton fans that it ended up sounding like the Kenton trombone section, and spreading the notes over the area of a five-part group. In lots of ways, a five-part group will double notes at times because there aren't five good ones. And we could get the good ones when the chances came and leave out the one that the bass is playing or the one that your ear accidentally hears anyhow and make a five-part sound and make it kind of instrumentally phrased. It's not a bunch of vocal nip-ups pronouncing words. It's a vocal group singing harmony chords and becoming like a section of voices.
The Freshmen signed to Capitol Records in 1950, but their first releases failed to sell well, and the label dropped them. It was Stan Kenton, their biggest advocate, who persuaded Capitol to go ahead and give the Freshmen copies of their recording It's a Blue World to distribute to radio DJs. The song took off, and Capitol ultimately re-signed the group. Ross Barber on how the song was a product of the Freshmen's early exploratory approach to singing.
It was discovery, not based upon what we'd been taught. It was based upon what we were learning at that time. And then when we went to college and got the quartet to singing, we got to challenging each other. In some of the arrangements, Hal would sing a ninth in the bass. And everybody accepts it, that part of the blessing of Blue World, to have Hal singing world from nine to do in the bass part, which just doesn't happen. But we didn't have any rules to follow, so we didn't follow any of them.
With you away.
Was the start of a series of freshman recordings that stamped themselves on the collective consciousness of a 1950s undergraduate following, including The Day Isn't Long Enough, How Can I Tell Her, Please Remember, and Angel Eyes. If you think you've heard the Four Freshmen sound before, you probably have, in the form of a group that came after them and whose primary creative personality counted himself as a fan. Indiana University professor of music Glenn Gass on the Four Freshmen Beach Boys connection.
If you heard Angel Eyes and with your eyes shut or didn't know what it was, I would assume it was, if you just heard the voices, that's Brian Wilson. I mean, it's uncanny how close it is. It's a real distinct style of singing, and you can tell that he really studied the Four Freshmen and really modeled his voice, worked on his high register to sound like that, to get exactly that sort of poignant quality to it. And then all the other voices are blend in the same way you'd hear in a Four Freshmen record as well. And the Beach Boys had the whole range covered, from Mike Love's best sort of low doo-wop bass up to, you know, this Brian and Carl, both great high singers. But I think it's the Four Freshmen are really, it's a real template. You know, you just take the Four Freshmen and sort of layer it on top of Chuck Berry and Dick Dale guitar bands, and then add more and more Phil Spector production touches as time goes by. And that's, you know, in a good way, the Beach Boys story.
Here's a snippet of the four freshmen singing Their Hearts Were Full of Spring, followed by the Beach Boys' version. Freshmen and the Beach Boys vocalizing on Bobby Troup's Their Hearts Were Full of Spring. It wasn't just their singing that kept the four freshmen sound compelling.
It became a thing, though, we would add different backgrounds to keep put a new shine on the freshmen. Oh, here are the freshmen with strings. Here are the freshmen with trombones. Here are the freshmen with five trumpets, that kind of thing. And packaging sales. The sales department said, well, let's get the freshman with five guitars. So we would invent something with five guitars so we could keep that new presentation of the same sound rather than repeat instrumentally and vocally the same thing each album.
In addition to recording their numerous concept albums, the freshmen kept up a prolific touring schedule across America, focusing especially on college campuses. Jazz radio personality Dick Bishop frequently saw the freshmen perform during their late 1950s heyday.
Well, of course, everybody was sort of buttoned down in those days. It wasn't like, you know, Pearl Jam or anything like that. I think everybody behaved themselves. One of the great aspects of their shows were the very quiet ballads.
Still, it's uncomfortably near. My old heart ain't gaining no ground because my angel eyes ain't here. Angel eyes, that old devil sent, they glow unbearable. Need I say that my love's misspent? Misspent with angel eyes tonight. So drink up, all you people. Order anything you see. Uncommonly clear. Gotta find who's now number one and why my angel eyes ain't here.
The four freshmen doing Angel Eyes live at Los Angeles' Compton Junior College in 1958. The freshmen also peppered their performances with humorous stage banter. Here they are at Purdue University in 1959.
Thank you for your warm welcome. We're glad to be here again. You've probably noticed we've gotten our kicks working with Stan here for the moment, then they close the curtain and no more band. They'll go and do what bands do on intermissions.
Can I go too?
No. You too eager. Now we'll need you here. Maybe it's good that we introduce the guys in the group. Bob, have you met Ken?
Hey,
no, I'm kidding. They've met. This is Bob. He interrupts. Bob, do you have anything you'd like to use to interrupt at the moment?
Yes, I do. Applause.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Look, now, Bob.
Not too much. You make the other fellas jump.
Yeah.
Bob, and this is thank you.
The humble one. And this is Ken. He never says anything. Ken, would you like to say something? No, he never says anything. And my name's Ross. I'll be talking to you.
He sure will.
And this is Don. He'll be making the jazz sounds on the guitar. Progress through the jazz sound. Don, jazz.
Say, that's real Indiana music, ain't it?
When it comes to real Indiana music, perhaps nobody personifies the term better than pianist and songwriter Hoagie Carmichael. Carmichael was born in Bloomington, Indiana on November 22, 1899. His mother played the piano in local theaters, and Carmichael came of age under the tutelage of an African-American pianist, Reginald Duvall, who told him to never play anything that ain't right. You may not make a lot of money, but you'll never get hostile with yourself. And at first, Hoagie didn't make a lot of money. Despite his popularity on the Indiana University Bloomington campus in the early 1920s, his first forays into composing, and his early associations with musicians such as Vix Beiderbecke, he ultimately tried to pursue law as a career.
And I went to Florida, and I tried to practice or become a lawyer in a period of 9 months. All of a sudden, through my window of my office, I heard a record being played across the street in the record shop, and it sounded familiar. I mean, the music did. And I ran across the street, and there was a record that Red Nichols had made of my washboard blues, and it was a tremendous record, a wonderful thing. Well, to make a long story short, I packed up my books and things, and I came north and got back into the music business.
Well, and you've been there ever since.
Yeah.
Thus did the world lose a mediocre lawyer and gain a superlative songwriter. Among the ranks of great American songbook composers, Carmichael biographer Richard Sudholer categorized Hoagie as one of a kind.
Most of the time, songs that became popular in the, say, early to middle 30s were of two types. They were either products of the Tin Pan Alley song mill and, you know, the Brill Building, which had come into existence in 1930, or they were songs from the Broadway stage, written by the guys who Carmichael loved to refer to as the big boys, you know, the Rodgers and Porter and Kern and Irving Berlin and all the rest of the people who were writing for the Broadway stage. Well, Hoagie belonged to neither of those categories. He was, in a way, a heartland person, a non-urban person, somebody who preferred to write about life in small town, generally small town, largely agrarian, largely past America.
For Sudholer, Carmichael's songs embody an essential impulse of place.
That current of home that flows like a lazy river, you might say, through all of, a good many of Carmichael's songs, whether in explicit form like Moon Country, or Memphis in June, or Georgia on My Mind. You know, Georgia could be any place. Memphis could be any place. They're not geographical points on the map. Or something as indirect as Winter Moon, which longs for a lost love somewhere sometime back, a better time. No matter what kind of a life he had in his maturity, you know, living very comfortably in California, appearing in movies and all the rest, I think that sting, that pain, that Heimweh, the German word, really stayed with him all his life.
That trademark Carmichael sense of bittersweet longing and remembrance is captured most famously in the song Stardust, famously said by Carmichael to have come to him one night while he was sitting at the edge of the Indiana University campus, across from his favorite hangout, the Book Nook, whereupon he dashed across the street, banged on the door of the closed restaurant, and cajoled its owner into letting him use the piano to work out the tune. And while Richard Sudholer has sussed out the song's more complicated evolution thoroughly in his Carmichael biography, the song's Halloween 1927 recording debut contains another magical moment, described by Jeanette Records historian Rick Kennedy.
It was a very haphazard recording session. He put a band together. There was a guy called Emil Seidel who had a dance band in downtown Indianapolis. And so it was mostly guys from that band who knew Hoagie well. They got in a car in the middle of the night and drove all the way to Richmond, which probably at that time, you know, Indianapolis to Richmond was probably a good 3-hour drive or more. And they arrive at 2, 3 in the morning with a song that had not been written down. He'd been humming the arrangements to the players. So it was a very raggedy version. And of course, they had to record and get right back in the car and go back and play a matinee at 1 in the afternoon in Indianapolis. So it was a hurried session. These guys hadn't had any sleep. They weren't very familiar with the song. But what's amazing is in the middle of the song, Hoagie Carmichael does a 33-bar solo. It was planned to be 32, but it came out 33. But it's a well-thought-out, very, very difficult piano solo to reproduce today.
The initial recording of Stardust was not a success, and when Hoagie re-recorded it a year later for Jeanette, singing lyrics that he'd written, Jeanette rejected it with the note already on Jeanette. Poor seller. The test pressing of this version was supposedly kept by Hoagie, but has never been found. The song itself, however, would gain its first glimmer of commercial immortality in 1930 with Isham Jones' Sweet Ballad arrangement. Isham Jones' 1930 recording of Stardust, which helped set the song on its way to becoming a beloved and oft-recorded ballad, aided as well by Mitchell Parrish's lyrics added in 1929. By some accounts, Stardust second only to the Beatles' Yesterday in the number of times it's been covered by other artists. Hoagie Carmichael's career would take him to New York in the 1930s and then to Hollywood, where he would eventually appear in films as well as writing music for them, establishing a cinematic presence that he once described as a hound dog-faced old musical philosopher noodling on the honky-tonk piano, saying to a tart with a heart of gold, "He'll be back, honey. He's all man." Carmichael established something else as well, in the view of Richard Sudhalter, a model for future musical artists.
I don't think I'm exaggerating here by saying that had it not been for him, we would not have had a Billy Joel or an Elton John or, you know, closer to home, a Dave Frischberg. The guy who sits at the piano sings his own songs in his inimitable fashion.
After winning an Academy Award with Johnny Mercer for Best Song in 1953, Carmichael would find his style of songcraft eclipsed by the rise of rock and roll, and at times in his later years would express bitterness that though he continued to write new music, nobody seemed much interested in recording it. But he had already written enough to build a legacy as one of America's foremost popular song composers, somebody who caught the spirit of the country in a way that nobody else had before or since.
It was a long road, you know, when he first went to New York and he started coming in contact with the big boys, saw George Gershwin hamming it up at parties and all the rest of it. He was, on the one hand, full of admiration. On the other hand, he was full of envy, saying, well, these guys have it all, and I'm just a yokel from Indiana. But the yokel had the last laugh, because he wound up writing songs that will, as far as I can see, never disappear from our sensibilities, our affections, our memories.
way down, way down.
I blaze the river where the old mill runs.
Old rocking chair got me.
Buttermilk sky, I'm a keeping my eye peeled on you. What's a good word tonight? Are you gonna be mellow tonight? Oh, buttermilk sky, can't you see my little donkey and me? We're as happy as a Christmas tree, heading for the one I love. I'm gonna pop her the question, that question. Do you, darling, do you do? It'll be.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you.
A shady veranda under a Sunday blue sky. Memphis in June and Cousin Amanda's making a rhubarb pie. I can hear the girls.
Out of cigarettes, holding hands and yawning. Look out, ladies, guests, two sleepy people by dawn's early light. Too much in love to say goodnight.
Took a look at the mercury 40 below. No life for a lady.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Soft rains fall and drift from leaves that I recall. The thrill of being sheltered in your arms, of course I do.
Mm-hmm.
Artie Shaw's Big Band in 1940 performing Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust. Thanks for tuning in to this special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, bringing the arts to all Americans. Special thanks to Dick Bishop, Glenn Gass, John Hassey, Timothy Noble, the Indiana University Archives of Traditional Music, and Nightlights production and research assistant John Porter. Production support for Nightlights also comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can listen to this and other Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.